everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams-Byers. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. And our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. Today, we're going to delve into the area of civil law and how it differs from criminal law. We'll try to walk you through a civil case and explain how its trajectory differs from a criminal matter. Well, let's talk about civil cases a little bit, Judge Gail. And first of all, when I used to teach students, I would ask them what a civil case was. And I can tell you that almost to the student, nobody knew what it was. So,
well, you don't get Dick Wolf doing television shows about civil cases so much.
They're just not as sexy. They just aren't as glamorous usually. Because all the students didn't know what a civil case was, it forced me to come up with a definition. So I'm going to give my definition of what a civil case is, and I'd like to get your response, okay?
Oh, I'm waiting with bated breath.
All right. A civil case is where one entity brings a legal action against another entity to correct a wrong. One entity brings a legal action against another entity to correct a wrong. Now, let me break that down further. I say entity because it can be a person versus a person. It could be a corporation versus a person. It could be a state or the federal government versus a person. It can be two corporations against each other. So that's what I mean. Entity is broadly defined. Now, when I say correct a wrong, it comes in two forms. One, to stop doing something or to continue to do something. That's injunctive type of civil law. But most commonly, the correct the wrong is money damages. The plaintiff, the party bringing the lawsuit, is suing the defendant to receive money damages for a wrong that they say the defendant committed against them. And there are two kinds of damages: compensatory, which means they compensate for the loss, or punitive, which means that they punish the defendant on top of the damages for loss. That's a civil case. What do you think, Judge Gail?
I think that's a really succinct and insightful definition and explanation. As usual, you are just a master of linguistics, because
I don't know about that.
My response would have been, hey, folks, these are largely the pocketbook cases. We've got a dispute. Of course, it could be between, and what I want our audience to be clear to understand is, just as you described, it can be, a person against a corporation. It can be a corporation against a person. It could be entities against entities. It can, one can be an agency or even a government and versus a person or vice versa. But at the end of the day, the most common response to civil cases is money, which is why I call them the pocketbook cases. But it can also be other things like property or, the resolution of issues, or as you said, an injunction or an order to stop doing something, or an order to do something as a result. Biggest difference is that in civil cases, unlike how some people may think of them in comparison to criminal cases, there's generally no term of incarceration that is involved. One of the biggest linchpins that distinguishes a criminal case from a civil case is the types of penalties, and that being the fact that a court, which courts resolve civil matters, and they hear civil matters just like they oversee, resolve, and adjudicate criminal matters, but the tools available to the court to resolve them are different. And in criminal matters, it can, and many times does, involve at least the option of imposing jail, incarceration, probation, some kind of sanction on the person's physical freedom. That is a tool that's commonly available in criminal matters, whereas in civil matters, that is not the case.
Well, civil cases, let me complicate it just a bit further.
Oh, by all means, yes.
A civil case also can be a criminal case. And what I mean by that is one action could be both criminal and civil. And let me give you an example. Judge Gale, I'm going to use you as a hypothetical here. Okay.
Oh, goodness. Let's just see how this works out.
All right. So I come by and somehow I am angry with you. I don't know about what. It doesn't matter. But I pick up a big stone, a big rock, and I heave it through your front window. And it crashes all over the place and cuts your arm. Okay? That's the fact situation. Mm-hmm. I'm angry with you. I heave a rock through your window. It crashes the window, and as a result, your arm gets cut. Okay, now that situation, one fact situation, can be both criminal and civil. On the criminal side, what would I be charged with? Probably criminal damaging, maybe assault,
attempted felonious assault, depending upon the nature of the damage, because it's the
exactly
cause and, or attempt and, to cause serious physical harm,
and the extent of your injury. But that's criminal. That means that the state would take action against me to perhaps incarcerate me or somehow penalize me for the wrong that I did to you. That criminal case, however, will not get your window replaced and will not pay for your medical bills that you're incurring while you go get your arm stitched up. So that would be a civil case. The state would take criminal action against me, but you, Judge Gale, would sue my butt to collect damages for your window and your arm. You think that's a good explanation of how something can be both criminal and civil?
You're absolutely right. I actually had a different analogy in mind, but this one is a great example of what you just described. Now, for the purpose of our audience, I'm going to complicate this just a tiny bit more.
Oh, please.
Because you're absolutely right in what you described. One tool that is still available to the court, to the prosecutor, and would be to me as the victim in this case, as it's resolving as a criminal matter, could be to ask the court during the criminal case for what's called restitution. And restitution is a term or a tool by the court that is used to restore the victim to the place that they were before the crime or the damages happened. Now, if the court orders restitution and it issues a judgment as part of that criminal case that says, yes, Tom, you now owe her $3,500 for the window and you know, $5,000 for medical expenses for a total of $8,500. And you have to pay that back to her through the clerk's office when you're paying any other fines or costs that the court imposes. What can happen is if you decide for whatever reason, you know, I'm just not paying. I'm not going to do it. You know what? She deserved it. She had it coming. And by the way, that window was always raggedy. So I think the court was wrong.
I don't feel bad at all.
Right. I don't feel bad at all. And instead of fighting it, I'm just not going to pay. What could happen under those circumstances is I having that court's order that says you owe me $3,500 for my window, $5,000 for my injuries and my medical bills. I can now take that court order in many jurisdictions, and once you have demonstrated you are not going to pay and you're not doing it and you've not paid anything, I can ask the court to convert that part of the order, that restitution, into what's called a civil judgment, because there are so a few more tools that I know we're going to talk about that can actually help me collect on that $8,500, including garnishing your wages to help recover my $8,500.
That means grabbing my wages before I get them. That's right. That's what garnishing means.
It means standing right next to, shoulder to shoulder with Uncle Sam.
It's when saying, he takes give your me, wages. Give me.
Yes. And so if you notice when you get your paycheck, your taxes are already deducted because the Uncle Sam does not trust you to just mail them in when you get around to it, so they take them off the top. Well, if there is an order to garnish or to take your wages, then that means that part of the judgment is going to be fulfilled out of any monies you earn where that are taxable wages. That money's going to be reduced and you'll get what's left over in your paycheck. So I can ask the court to use a tool available to it as under the civil laws to say this was a criminal case. The court said that he was supposed to pay. He did not pay. And he's indicated he's not going to pay, and we've waited a reasonable period of time. Can we please now turn this part into a civil judgment? And in many instances, it doesn't even require that you go back to the court for an additional hearing. It's merely a motion or a request that you make to the court to convert that to that part of the criminal judgment into a civil judgment to use those tools to collect.
Let me complicate things just one step further, okay?
Sure.
So let's switch up the hypothetical, and you're driving your vehicle and I'm driving mine, and we have a collision in the middle of an intersection. The police officer comes to investigate the accident and decides that he can't figure out, or she can't figure out, what the hell went on. And so cites both of us with traffic offenses. I don't care what the offenses are, but charges both. And in our state, those are criminal actions. Mm-hmm. So those are criminal actions. Civilly, you could not order restitution there because you still don't know whose fault the accident was. You know both parties violated the traffic laws, but you still don't know whose fault the accident was. That would be resolved in a civil case where one party would sue the other to say, you're at fault and I want to collect damages from you. Would that be accurate?
That would be absolutely accurate. It would be accurate. And if I can, and so again, another complication to all of this, right?
Please do.
I'd like to add another layer to this cake we're making. And okay, if we go back to your first example of the rock thrown through the window where there's a damage to the person and the property, another option would be for me, who's damaged and maybe I'm waiting for you to make good on restitution and pay for the window. And you know, maybe there's health insurance that helps to pay for some of the damages to the medical bills that I'm experiencing.
Right.
What I could do while you've not paid for the window, if I am maybe a renter and I have renter's insurance, or if I'm a homeowner and I have homeowner's insurance, I could then file a claim with my homeowner's insurance indicating that I've been the victim of a crime from you throwing the rock through the window, and ask essentially the insurance company to come in and to make me whole, right? To pay for the window and right. to fix everything. And when I do that, the insurance company also has an interest to make sure that the claims that they're paying on behalf of their claim holders are appropriate. And if there are wrongdoers, that those wrongdoers make the insurance company whole. So the insurance company, and let's say it's any random insurance company, let's say ABC Insurance, so as not right. to give a plug to anyone in particular. So ABC right. Insurance says, no problem, we're going to come in and we're going to replace your window and we're going to make you whole. But what we're now going to do is we're going to stand in your shoes, and we are now going to sue Tom on your behalf, or on behalf of the insurance company. We're going to sue him because we want to get our money back. You have a court order that says he's supposed to pay. He didn't. Obviously, and we all know, insurance companies tend to have deeper pockets than the average John right. Q. public. Right. And they have an entire squadron of attorneys that can go after Tom with a vengeance. And so they can seek what's called subrogation, or to be made whole, because what they paid out to me was only the result of Tom's behavior. And they want their money back from Tom. Now, the court may have already ordered that, and maybe, you know, I haven't been aggressive enough in getting that money. That's okay, because I can get my window fixed and I can tell the insurance company, Tom's got your money, so go get them. And they then can bring a civil action. This is why I call these pocketbook cases. They can bring a civil action against Tom seeking to recover or to get back any monies they paid out on my behalf.
So let's circle back on the first example with me throwing the rock through the window.
That'll learn you.
One entity bringing a legal action against another entity to correct a wrong, back to my definition, you would be the one entity that brings the action, you know, so it'd be Judge Gale versus Judge Tom. And to correct the wrong would be to pay for the window and pay for the damages to your arm. Second example, it would be if you got money from your insurance company, it would be ABC Insurance Company would be the entity bringing the action against Judge Tom to reimburse the insurance company for what they paid you. In our auto accident, it would probably be you suing me, saying I was at fault, and me suing you, claiming you were at fault. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But all of our examples circle back to the one definition, one entity bringing a legal action against another to correct a wrong.
And I'd like to throw this out there to you, because I think one of the more, you know, and maybe I'm dating myself by saying this, maybe one of the most famous examples of a single act resulting in two cases, one being criminal, one being civil, was the unfortunate demise of Nicole Brown Simpson.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
the prosecution of her then husband, O.J. Simpson, and then later the wrongful death lawsuit that was filed also against him, even though in the criminal matter, he was acquitted. And it also bears to, I think, point out that the outcome of one case doesn't necessarily impact the outcome of another case. So someone can be charged and indicted and even prosecuted criminally for an act. And even if they're ultimately acquitted, then they could also still face civil liability, or they could face a civil case that could have a totally different outcome. Because in that case, O.J. Simpson was actually found liable in order to pay quite a bit for the wrongful death of the two victims in that matter.
And while you're saying that, we should note that in to win a criminal case, the government needs to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And we've talked Indeed. About that. That's the top standard, the toughest standard, because you might be taking away somebody's life or liberty. So you have to prove them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil case, that burden is only what's called a preponderance of the evidence, which is whatever slight bit beyond 50%. If you think it's 51% that Judge Gale should win in her lawsuit against Judge Tom, then she's won the case. You know, you don't have to convince a jury unanimously, and you don't have to convince them to the utmost burden of proof. In fact, it is probably the least, beyond probable cause, the least strenuous burden of proof.
It is a very low bar. And I actually, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. My sense is that this system was set up because we've always kind of appreciated that to require someone to pay money or to compensate financially is not as onerous as the thought of someone's liberty being.
That's exactly right. You know, somebody's liberty being taken away, mm-hmm. you have to prove it at the utmost standard. But just somebody dipping into somebody's pocketbook, as you right. mentioned, you know, just a little more than 50%. That's all.
Yeah, we certainly say you know if you crash a piggy bank, then you know it may not be comfortable, you may not like it, but you can recover a lot easier from paying out money than you will days of your life or years or your life in total.
Yeah.
You cannot recover as easily, which is also why when we see cases that are ultimately overturned for wrongful convictions, the payout for the loss of time that those incarcerated may have been incarcerated, thereby losing their freedom, tend to be pretty enormous. There's right. no small thing to say what someone's to place a financial value on someone's freedom. That tends to be pretty big.
So I'm going to start in with how a civil case then is initiated. And it's started by the plaintiff, the person bringing the legal action, filing a written document with a court. And that written document is called a complaint. Now, in the complaint, the plaintiff has to list what a basic set of facts of what occurred and why the defendant might be liable and under what theory of law. Now, when I say theory of law, it could be a breach of contract case. It could be a medical malpractice case. It could be a pretty ordinary negligence case. There are all kinds of civil kinds of cases that are routinely brought, but you have to say under what theory you're bringing the case. So the accident situation that we talked about, it would be negligence. One side was negligent because they broke the law and they caused the accident. So that is in a written document called a complaint. And one extra thing I should mention is that with the complaint is usually served a jury demand. Now, you may say, well, don't all cases go to a jury? No, they don't. In a felony case, a criminal case, a jury is automatic. However, in a civil case, either party can request a jury. It's not automatic. And if you don't request it in the complaint or the answer, then it is waived. In other words, you can't get it. You're giving up your right to have a jury trial, and then it would be decided by the judge. So the complaint and the jury demand are filed with the clerk of whatever court the case is being tried in, and then it is served on the defendant, sometimes by certified mail, sometimes by personal service. And then we get into a complicated area, Judge Gale, and that is once the document is served on the defendant has a ton of options. First, the defendant has to answer the complaint saying, yes, you're right on this fact. No, you're not right on that fact. I deny this. I don't have enough information on that to confirm or deny. It's basically going through the plaintiff's complaint and answering the allegations, which sets up the framework of the lawsuit, what actually is being contested. Simple answers are pretty easy, but then we get into the whole idea of counterclaims, cross complaints, and third-party complaints. That gets sticky, doesn't it?
Oh, does it? Yes, absolutely. It only makes for, again, a more tangled web, if you will, for a civil case that can seems like it's going in one direction and take off in a totally, completely different direction.
A counterclaim, let's just work on some definitions and see if you can add further complications to my definitions. A counterclaim is when the defendant sues the plaintiff. And let's use our automobile accident case in our intersection. You and I have a collision. You sue me for damages to your vehicle and injuries you sustained. I answer and say, I'm not responsible for that. That's my answer. But then in the same lawsuit, I sue you and say, no, it was not my fault. It was your fault, Judge Gale. And you're responsible for my injuries and my damage to my vehicle. That would be a simple counterclaim.
Yes, which essentially says, yes, not only am I not responsible for what you're saying, you actually caused me harm, and I might have let it slide until you sued me. And now that you sued me, I'm now going to claim against you. And so if you think about the V in the middle of cases, it's usually, John Q. Public versus, Ann Q. Public or, ABC Insurance, whomever. And they often are on opposite sides of the V for versus. So it starts with, maybe the first person filing the claim against the other person on the other side of the V. If you think of a counterclaim as that person now sending the arrow back to the first side of the V to claim against the original claimant.
Yeah, just as an aside, do you know when you use the V and when you use the initials VS to equate to versus?
That is really interesting. It sounds like a lifeline question.
I looked it up the other day.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I looked it up the other day. And the standard rule is that you use just the V in legal cases. So it would be Judge Gale v. Judge Hodson.
When it's one person.
Judge Tom. Multiple things. The V is used in legal parlance. The VS is used in sports parlance.
Really?
Yeah. So Ohio State versus Michigan is VS. Yeah. Judge Gale versus Judge Tom in court is a V. So that's an aside definition. Now, let's say
really is a game show question. Let's hold that in your back pocket a game show.
I will. I'll pull that out. We'll make that part of the quiz at the end of our episode here. So let's say there are two defendants in a civil case where you have the plaintiff versus defendant number one and defendant number two, saying both defendants are responsible for damage to the plaintiff. Defendant number one and defendant number two are responsible. So you have the answers that's been filed, and defendant number one files a counterclaim back saying, no, no, you are responsible, plaintiff, for the damage, and so I'm suing you. So we have lawsuit number one, which is plaintiff versus defendant one and two. We have lawsuit number two, defendant one going back against the plaintiff. And then we have lawsuit number three to complicate it further. And that's called a cross claim or a cross complaint, where the defendants sue each other. So defendant one says, hey, if there was any liability here, it wasn't me, it was you, defendant number two. So I'm going to file a lawsuit against you. So now in one lawsuit, we have three different lawsuits going on at the same time. Plaintiff versus defendant one and two, defendant one versus plaintiff, and defendant one versus defendant two. You have to draw diagrams, Judge Gale, to figure this out.
To keep up. It can be complicated, but also consider the fact that there are so many who believe that even in all of what we've described so far, they find civil law and civil procedure to be a lot easier to understand than criminal law and criminal procedure. And that's interesting to me. What I'll also say is what you just described about a cross claim is not limited to the defendant's side of the V, if you will. Cross claims can be filed between co-plaintiffs, if you will. I don't think it's as common as cross complaints being cross claims between co-defendants, but it is possible to do that. But you're right, born out of a single complaint can become, you know, kind of a matrix, if you will, of additional cases the court has to kind of mine its way through between the various parties.
Okay, so let's go to next to last in kinds of complaints, and that is a third party
complaint.
And so let me try a definition on that. We have plaintiff versus defendant, defendant counterclaims against plaintiff, but defendant thinks, hey, I'm not responsible. There's somebody out there who is responsible, who hasn't been made a party to this lawsuit. I want to bring them in because if anybody's going to pay, they're going to pay. So
now, can I pause you right there to make this make sense to our audience?
Please.
Just a little bit, right? So if we go back to the example of the rock or the brick thrown through the window of the home, damaging the window and also causing the physical damage, consider the idea that maybe Judge Tom was not by himself. He wasn't acting alone. He had actually been driven to the location by someone and paid by that person to engage in that behavior. So there's someone maybe pulling the strings, allegedly, very responsible. Someone maybe lured me to my home so that I could be there and now has provided Judge Tom with all the information as well as the rock to throw through the window, the rock, the ride, the information, and money as an incentive to actually throw the rock. That, in fact, could be the defendant that's not originally named in the lawsuit, but once Judge Tom gets sued for damages to the window and is looking to be made responsible for all of the damages, he may say, wait, wait, wait. I wasn't the one really responsible for this. There's another person that hasn't even been identified by the plaintiff, hasn't been sued here, but needs to be brought in as a third party because they're really the one that's responsible.
Yeah, and I'm going to bring in anybody who has a possible chance of getting me off the hook. Yeah. And so it's not uncommon to have third-party complaints. That's why civil cases often take so long, because they get so complicated so early on. The last part of the initial complaints I wanted to talk about is the concept of interpleader. Now, that sounds like a fancy term, but let me give you an example, a concrete example. This is a true case that's ongoing. I'm following a case where a city was scammed out of $750,000 by computer scammers. They sent money to a out-of-state account, bank account in Kentucky, thinking that they were paying a bill for a major construction project, and instead the money went to scammers.
So, that's incredible. I just got to pause and say, that's so incredible.
The city does a lawsuit trying to recoup money. The defendants are John Doe and Jane Doe, which means they don't know who the scammers are, but they're preserving their ability to sue. So they file the lawsuit. All of a sudden, the bank who is holding the money in Kentucky, held the money in Kentucky, says, oh, by the way, we still have a couple $100,000 in that account. But the problem is that City A in Ohio has a claim on it, and Construction Company B in Florida has a claim on the money because they were both scammed by the same scammer. So what we want to do is we want to join your lawsuit, City, and we want to have the court order us to just hold the money, and we will then give it to whoever the court tells us to. So we want to add the company in Florida, who also has a claim on the money, to the original lawsuit from the city, and we want to join as third-party plaintiffs and sue everyone so that we're off the hook. That's an interpleader. And that's a real case that's going on right now.
It is like, stakeholders playing hot seat or something.
Yeah, really. The bank says, the bank has a great point. The bank said, look, I don't want to be sued in Ohio for this. And, had the judge give me one order paying the city so much of this money that we still have. And I then get sued in Florida by the construction company, and a judge in Florida orders me to pay money. I don't want to be in two different jurisdictions. I just want to bring it all in one.
Indeed. And in this instance, there's a lot, I think, of contemplation that goes into all of these decisions. And in this instance, for the bank to say what they said, they're also not in the business of trying to pay twice, right?
So right.
They would like, in order to be in compliance with what could be competing court orders. If you've got, again, as you described, a court order that from one jurisdiction that directs them to act one way while another directs them to act completely different, what they are saying is, we think the most efficacious way to handle this is to bring everybody in. And although we don't really have a dog in this race, other than the fact that we're holding the bag of money that needs to be distributed, all we really want at the end of the day is to make sure that everybody's going to abide by whatever the ultimate ruling is, and that we're not going to be stuck paying twice. Exactly. That's really smart. And it's also an insurance policy for the bank.
Right. The bank's going, look, you know, we've got a couple of $100,000 here. You know, we can't fully reimburse either party. We don't know whether we should give it to the city or whether we should give it to this construction company or whether we should divide it. And how do we divide it? Yeah, so it was a very smart move on the part of the bank to join this lawsuit that they were not a party of initially.
And remember, you're going to have the construction company, even in Florida, presumably arguing. And this is, you know, I think when we get down to the point of the substance of some of these cases, they're going to argue, hey, listen, we still perform the work. So just because you got scammed doesn't mean you don't still owe the bill. It just means you got scammed paying the bill.
Yeah.
And so whatever the bank is holding should be applied toward the work that's already been completed because that's part of the original contract. And of course, there will be a different argument, I think, from the plaintiffs, from the city, that's saying, hey, getting scammed was never part of the contract or the contemplation. And we have a duty to safeguard these funds. And now that we know it's been scammed, we need to recover what we can so that we can recalibrate and figure out how we are, you know, how we're going to move forward. So,
well, it makes a complex legal situation that you and I are trying to, you know, use these terms to elaborate. You know, this gets very complicated. Civil law gets very complicated.
Indeed.
All right, let's move on. So we've these initial documents that we've just talked about are called pleadings. And once the pleading part of the lawsuit is over, then we get into what takes the longest period of time, and that's called discovery. Now, Judge Gale, you and I have talked about discovery in criminal cases a little bit. Discovery in civil cases make criminal discovery look like losers, you know?
Yes. If you think of a criminal case, it's usually, okay, who are the witnesses? What are the statements? What is the evidence?
Do you have any reports?
Yeah, any reports, any videos, any recordings, any statements from any witnesses? What are you going to use? And we're good to go. And we can kind of go from there. And we're off to the races sometimes with negotiating. In civil cases, however, you can have so much discovery and it can entail so many things that it literally takes an entire team attorneys and paralegals to literally go through everything in order to pinpoint what's really germane to the case itself.
And big law firms have discovery teams.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, and that's all they do is mine through discovery for purposes of kind of pulling out what's important and what's necessary for use. But it can be, I suspect, because I've never done big law firm work, so this is a disclosure on my part, but I suspect it could be pretty, it could be overwhelming given how much of it can exist.
It is overwhelming. And let's talk about just maybe four kinds of discovery. And there really are limitless kinds of discovery. But the four main ones, and let's start with number one, and that's production of documents. You know, in a civil case, you can ask the other party to produce all kinds of documents. That means internal correspondence. That means emails. That means text messages. That means scientific reports, accident reconstruction. You know, just any kind of document you can imagine will in fact be requested. And this is voluminous. And in some cases, literally, folks out there are warehouses full of documents. So we're not talking about 2 or 3, 10, 20. You know, we're talking about massive kinds of documents in big civil cases.
Indeed. And it's also a really good time as these document productions are being responded to. This is often the time when civil attorneys, similar to what could and doesn't often, but I think is more frequent in civil cases, civil attorneys will file a motion with the court asking or to help ensure that there is no what's called spoilation of evidence, meaning any effort to destroy or alter or withhold relevant evidence in the case. And this can be anything, just like you were saying, the types of evidence where you have like entire warehouses full of it. It's not just pieces of paper. It could be, you know, efforts to delete emails or destroy recordings or, you know, make witnesses or witness statements unavailable. Anything that would, again, hamper access to that evidence or that information could be considered spoilation of evidence. And it is entirely appropriate if you believe that there is even the likelihood that that could happen. Attorneys sometimes preemptively or in advance file motions with the court, asking the court to enter an order that neither party engage in spoilation of evidence. So there can be full discovery, no matter how much it is, there can be a full discovery exchange between both sides so that the case can go forward. Now, there are sanctions or penalties for when evidence is spoiled. There are consequences for when it's spoiled or when it's destroyed. And these can run the gamut, and we could talk about those at a later time. Everything from sanctioning the attorneys to, you know, not permitting the use of certain or introduction of certain evidence at trial or as part of the case if they believe that some parts of it have been spoiled. But this is a good time to ask for it, to make sure that as this exchange is taking place, neither side is trying to get a leg up by withholding or keeping away from the other side something that might be perceived as damaging.
On the other side of that equation, the party against whom the production of documents is issued, the party holding the documents, can also file with the court and say, this is too extensive. They're asking for things that are totally irrelevant. This is too onerous for us to do. So those are called requests for protective orders. And, you know, this is what makes discovery so long. Somebody asks for a series of documents, and then there's a motion for protective orders. There's a motion against spoilage. And it goes back and forth before we even get to the exchange of documents. It's an elongated process.
Indeed. And sometimes, and I wonder if you'd agree with this, sometimes it's used to frustrate process.
Or to run up attorney fees on people.
Indeed.
You know, the more discovery you do, the more the other side's going to have to pay their attorneys, and therefore they may be more apt to settle the case or give you a certain amount of cash that you demand before a trial.
Hence the pocketbook cases. So now we're talking, you know, maybe quarters on the dollar or, nickels on the dollar. But yeah.
But if I'm going to have to pay my attorney $1 million to protect against a potential $500,000 judgment, it's going to make sense.
I might cut my losses. Yes,
that I cut my losses and I try to settle that case.
Yes, but if I have to pay my attorney $1 million to settle a multi-million dollar or multi-billion dollar lawsuit amongst multiple individuals or multiple entities or agencies, then I might also think about the worthiness of that investment.
Right. Another kind of discovery, real quick, and I'm not going to spend much time on this one, is a request for admissions. One party asks the other party to admit certain facts that they've outlined in a document. And 9 times out of 10, the other party denies them. You know, so it's sort of a waste of time, actually.
I will admit nothing, not even my name.
That's right. I admit nothing. But that is a form of discovery. But after you have the production of documents and you get really into the nitty-gritty of the case, then comes the process of interrogatories. Interrogatories are written questions presented from one party to another that have to be answered in writing and under oath.
Within a certain period of time.
Yeah. So that's an interesting, it's sort of a way to get people locked into a statement or a theory or to a fact by having it under oath prior to trial. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting process, but also it's a long process. Even though you have a short period of time to answer the interrogatories, they can have follow-up interrogatories. You know, it's not just one and done.
They can feel never ending because the answers to certain questions often lead to or elicit additional questions, which are the subsequent interrogatories you're speaking of, which can feel like it, as you said, elongates the process more. It just draws it out that much more. So, you know, you said the sun was setting that day, you know, what was the temperature? Where was your car located? Or, you know, how were you feeling that day? Had you had any other procedures? It really can invite like all kinds of subsequent questions that at least on their face may not seem like they're germane to the case itself. But this is also part of a larger strategy for each side in seeking the information. Again, it may not feel or look like it makes a lot of sense to the person that's responsible for responding, but it is very strategic.
The last part of discovery that I want to talk about are depositions. And a deposition is the taking of the oral testimony of a witness, doesn't have to be a party, of a witness prior to trial, and it's under oath, and one party gets to ask the questions. The party asking for the deposition gets to ask the other witness or party questions, and the questions have to be answered under oath. Now, there are two types of depositions. One is a discovery deposition where you're trying to get information out of a witness, perhaps an expert on the other side. You really want to probe that expert to see what kind of testing procedures they went through or whatever. So it's pure discovery. A second kind of deposition is called a testimonial deposition. And that's where you're actually taking the testimony of someone outside of the courtroom, but under oath. And both parties would get to ask questions of the witness at that point. This happens oftentimes in negligence cases where there's a physical injury and the physician can't come to court, or you don't want to tie up the physician for a whole day, a surgeon, for example. You take that surgeon's deposition ahead of time, and so both parties know what that person's going to say.
It also lessens the likelihood that there's going to be objections to...
And if there are objections, they're stated, and then the judge makes the decision in court as the deposition's being played back.
Precisely.
Those testimonial depositions are usually done on video. Discovery depositions aren't always done on video, but most of the time now they are. So this discovery process is a long, involved process. It takes months, if not years, on certain cases. And meanwhile, the judge, and I want Judge Gale to jump in here, the judge sort of steps in to monitor what's going on in the case. The judge doesn't sit totally on the sidelines. The judge has a series of what are called status conferences.
Yes, or case management conferences.
Or pre-trials, or even settlement conferences. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yes. So, as you said, the judge's role is really actually involved to the extent that, yes, you want to provide the parties the latitude to find the information they need to decide if, in fact, this is a case that should be tried or if it's a case that should be resolved with a settlement. And so the purpose of the status conferences or the case management hearings is to bring the parties in, and particularly the attorneys, to encourage them to continue talking to each other, to fulfill these discovery obligations, but also to get a sense and basically to do a pulse check of the case itself. Where are we? What do you have? What do you need? What have you digested? Have you talked to your client? And if you've talked to your client, where are we with regard to potentially settling? So settlement conferences are designed to help avoid an actual trial, whether it's a jury or a bench trial. And as Judge Tom, you said at the top of this episode, is that the complaints that are filed are generally filed with a jury demand, although the parties can change their mind at any time and waive the jury and have the case tried to the court, especially if they think they've been getting some signaling, whether they read it wrong or not. If they think they've been getting signaling from the court that the court might be leaning more so in their favor, they may be less inclined to proceed with the jury if they think they have a favorable jurist. But a settlement conference is actually designed to use that opportunity for the court to kind of engage in more refereeing, if you will, almost like a mediation of sorts.
And even you said the magic word, and even recommend sometimes a court-ordered mediation, where the parties are forced to go through a mediation process to see if the case can't be settled.
Correct.
The judge going, you know, this case is ripe for mediation. I've tried thousands of these. And, you know, so get your parties, get together. I'm appointing this mediator, and get back to me in a month or two and tell me how it's going.
Yeah. And sometimes all it takes is saying those words for the parties to say, hold on there, judge, hold on. Just give us a minute. We want to go and, you know, have a chat, and then we'll go talk to our clients. We'll get right back to you. And the court can say, okay, in the meantime, I've got a couple more cases to handle. Why don't you all, you know, maybe talk amongst yourselves and get back to me? Because maybe court-ordered mediation, which, by the way, is with a separate mediator who hasn't necessarily done the same kind of rapport building, if you will, with the parties that the court has.
And who is not the judge, right?
And who is not the judge. There's a bit of disincentive to go that route if you believe that you can get as favorable a possible outcome for your client. Because remember, the mediator is the unknown commodity now. The judge is or has been the known commodity. If you are now required to go and to go to court order mediation, that's an unknown commodity where you kind of have to start, alerting or building up the knowledge base of that mediator from the beginning, and certainly trying to win them over to your side, which is ultimately the goal of both sides, right? Is to win the decision maker over to their side.
Go ahead. No. Well, I was just going to say, as judge, though, you know the mediators and you know their track record. And so, you know, I would give really head-busting mediators on cases where I knew they'd come out with a settlement. And the attorneys who have had that mediator before go, oh, my God, we don't want that. And end up settling the case. So the judge does have a role in selecting the mediator and how the case may come out.
You are absolutely right. I thought about this because sometimes judges are mediators, right? Sometimes retired judges act as mediators. I can tell you about my own personal experience, actually not long after taking the bench, maybe 2012, 2013. And literally, I don't even know if the ink was dry on my commission from the governor. And, you know, the mayor of the city began, you know, really raising a ruckus over the court's budget. And, you know, that is not terribly uncommon for judges. But it was something uncommon for me because I just didn't know what to expect. And literally within the first few months of being on the bench, the Supreme Court of Ohio had ordered us to mediation, and our mediator was a former judge. And the former judge was actually really, and not that I had expected it, but he was really, really clear to articulate what the role of the administration was with regard to court budgeting, which, by the way, folks, just so that we're all aware, local governments don't operate any different from federal governments. The legislative body holds the purse strings, no matter who it is. So it's either Congress or it's your local city council, or maybe it's your county council. But these
state
are your these are your legislative bodies. And in this instance, it was actually the executive branch that was sitting across the table, which now, that it, you know, when I look at this, it was the absolute wrong person to be across the table, but it was, you know, out of deference. Quite frankly, yeah, again, Congress does not, our federal Congress has no responsibility to abdicate its authority to the executive branch, no more than it would happen or should happen at a local level. But I had, at that time, I was dealing with an administration that was so aggressive and so disrespectful to the judiciary. They just didn't care anything about what the legislative branch did. They believed that they had the authority to set the budget for all branches of government and that the court's budget wasn't what they wanted it to be. And so they were there resisting the court's budget, even though there is no law anywhere that vests an executive branch with the authority to dictate the budget for a court. That's what the legislative branch is for. But I say that to say, I remember sitting in that room with a retired judge who was also trying to educate the executive branch about what their role and responsibility was with regard to budgets and budgets for other branches of government, which really amounted to zero. You have no role.
Being and they didn't hear it. Being a mediator is tough.
It's tough.
I'd rather be a judge than a mediator.
And it's really hard when you have ignorant people on the other side, and ignorant to the extent that either they don't know or they're unwilling. It's hard to believe that the, you know, that the executive branch of the city was actually represented by counsel, because that says so much for the attorneys on that side who also could not apparently exercise any client control and explain that they are the wrong party sitting across the table because they have no authority. They have no role. Their role is to receive their budget from the legislative branch, just like everybody else and just like how Congress does everyone else federally. But as a judge playing those dual roles, I could only imagine how this judge was feeling about this experience, and probably not very unique. So it does happen. Folks, it does happen. It's not just federal. As Tip O'Neill says, all politics is local.
Yeah, that's true. So we're over our time, but I want to wrap up here and say, okay, let's say mediation doesn't work and the case goes to trial. Three things I want to point out very quickly. First, jury size is usually smaller in civil cases than in criminal cases. Criminal cases, it's 12 members to a jury. Different states have different numbers for civil cases. Some have 8. And the jury verdict does not have to be unanimous. In a criminal case, it has to be unanimous. But in a civil case, it's usually a percentage, like 6 of 8, so, which makes it 3/4 of the jury would have to agree on a particular verdict. And the final thing, real quickly, is that burden of proof. And we talked about this at the top of the show. Criminal case, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And civil case, it's just a preponderance of the evidence. That's a whirlwind tour through civil law, Judge Gale.
Which I hope helps our listeners and makes you ready for the next time someone dare files a complaint and puts your name on either side of the V.
There you go. How people listen to us, and what do we want them to do if they do?
Oh my gosh, we are so grateful that you listen to us and that you tune in to Next Witness, Please. We encourage you to check us out, first of all, on NPR at NPR's directory. They've been extraordinary supporters and sponsors of this important educational information we provide you. But you can also find us on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon as well. And we encourage you to not just listen, not just like, which we hope you do, but also subscribe so that you can be notified every time there's a new episode of Next Witness, Please.
We try to come out at least once every 10 days. We try to do it weekly, but sometimes our schedules just won't allow us to do that. But as Judge Gale said, if you're a subscriber, when we come out with a new episode, it'll be right there on your phone or on your computer. So please subscribe. Next Witness, Please. And if you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can email them to me. You can do that at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. Also, if you have any topics you would like for us to cover in the future, please shoot us an email. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.